It's a king when the whole world was run by kings, and we were successful. We published the most revolutionary document in human history when the Declaration of Independence said we get our rights not from the king, but from our creator. There's nothing better that's been written about freedom since then. We have the first and oldest constitution. Our constitution is 100 years older than the Italian constitution. George Washington left office on his own volition, and King George was commenting, he'll be the greatest man in history if he leaves office voluntarily. Upon conquering other nations, we helped them and set them free. And we've had radical inventions. The atomic bomb, Morse's telegraph, the telephone, mass industrial production, Henry Ford, the television, space travel, the transistor, the integrated circuit. I worked for 18 years at Intel, and I was assistant to the inventor of the integrated circuit, Robert Noyce. The personal computer, the internet, social media, and we put on our money in God we trust. And the rest of the sentence is, and not the king. We are the real revolutionary. It's one of the reasons why we're not always popular. So I have four recommendations for our response to anti-Americanism. And they're in line with Mr. Regney's excellent article in ISI's publication right outside on the pillars of American conservatism. And I'm going to mention Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, London, and Philadelphia. The first recommendation is that we must keep the faith. Judaism gave us the idea of monotheistic God as well as natural law. And God is the source of order and justice. By recognizing God, one acknowledges that man does not possess all wisdom and owes his existence to a higher power. The humility involved in faith creates the mindset for governmental service and government's true role. And so our first task as conservatives is to be faith-filled people and govern our lives and our nation in this spirit. Now, this is a very personal decision and path. It's demanding, it's never-ending, like T.S. Eliot's poem last night, and government must only allow it, not require it, which is part of American exceptionalism. Second is, we must privatize our educational system. The idea of universal education is fundamental. The value and wisdom of government doing the education of our children has passed. In Athens, the city of Plato and Aristotle, we received the core ideals about ethics, politics, and science, and about how to live a good life and examine life. Ethics establishes character, and education builds culture. The story of Socrates reminds us how vital to every society is the education of the youth. Moreover, as we've moved from the machine age to the information age, one's success as a citizen rests much more on the quality of education than the strengths of your arms and legs, as in the machine age. I live in Alexandria, Virginia. 60% of the children, K through 12, in my city go to private schools. And we have the state's only formally declared failed high school. We have a president who says he's for public education, but his two daughters go to the most expensive school in my community. Today we bemoan, and our president bemoans, the growing income gap and a shrinking of the middle class, which will only worsen absent equalizing educational opportunity. This change is the single most important thing we can make after our faith. Next, we must radically renew American federalism. Rome taught us that the best and highest form of government is the republic, a republic that provides separation of powers, checks and balances, the division of governmental focus we call federalism. And London gave us the Magna Carta and reminded us about the rule of law, which is what our founders gave us, and that's why we're in Philadelphia today. These men in Philadelphia used those lessons from Rome and from London to do the hardest thing known to man, and that is create a free and prosperous society based on laws and not men. But today, Washington is torn by debates the founders never meant to occur in Washington. The founders designed a national government to look outward, foreign policy and trade. And the states and localities were designed to look inward toward the people. But our president today spends most of his time talking about education, healthcare, reproductive rights, redistribution of wealth, and shovel-ready highway jobs. He is not the governor of Illinois. He is the president of the United States, and we have a competitive and dangerous world he needs to spend his time on and not these issues. Abortion and birth control, education, transportation, funding of police and firefighters. Our president, when he was doing the stimulus bill, appeared before firefighters in Cleveland, Ohio, on the front page of the Washington Post, saying that our stimulus bill is funding these firefighters. This is the president of the United States. The abortion issue is especially instructive. Prior to 1973, U.S. Supreme Court nominees were examined based on their life's work. Ever since Roe v. Wade nationalized what had been a state issue, all the discussions about Supreme Court justice today are simply, are they pro-choice or pro-life? These are vital issues. These are moral and emotional issues. On the national stage, they tear the fabric of the republic because they are binary in nature, and that's why there should be 50 discussions and not one. These national debates make us appear shrill and intolerant before the world. They divide our people and our communities. They detract from the truly national issues before our leaders in Washington. And finally, number four, we conservatives need to conserve the future. We need to involve the next generation of Americans in our work. ISI, the Fund for American Studies, Claremont, the Philadelphia Society, etc., must all double and triple the young people that they involved. I'm delighted, Bill and Julie, we have a lot of young people today. We need to, of course, increase that. Every American campus needs a Madison program like the one that Robert E. George has built at Princeton University, and on and on. In summary, we must keep the faith, privatize our education, radically renew American federalism, and conserve the future with our young people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. You've already helped us segue from the international to the domestic dimension of our topic.
Thank you very much. Certainly great to be at the Philadelphia Society. Again, I've been here many times for many years, and I also appreciate all the people coming here in the spring. You know, one of the problems I've always had with the Philadelphia Society is that your meeting always takes place in the nicest weekend in the spring, and if there's one thing I hate to do, it's spend the weekend in a hotel on days like we had yesterday and Friday. But nevertheless, here we are. Let me start off with a few observations of things that I heard over the last couple of days and tell you a couple of stories and other things that the way I perceive it. To begin with, it seems to me that it's pretty obvious that we are engaged in a death struggle with the left. It's a worldwide struggle, and I think if you look at what goes on in the world, you can probably almost put everything that we've been talking about into that battle between the right and the left. And very frankly, as Mr. Bybach said, others, the United States really stands for what is right still, even though it's maybe not as clear as it used to be, but the principles of what America stands for are the principles that the left hates and which the left wants to defeat. And frankly, I think a great deal of what is termed anti-Americanism is what has been generated by the left as almost a ruse, because it's a convenient way for them to convince people that the American principles are wrong. And as John said, and I'm going to talk about also, we have really we have forgotten about the things that we can do to correct that. There are certain principles, as Mr. Maybach said also, that I think are clear. He mentioned the piece that I wrote that is in the current issue of the Intercollegiate Review. It was a speech that I gave in February to undergraduates at the Citadel on the foundations of American conservatism. And what I concluded was there were four principles of conservatism which are really the principles that America was built on. And those are liberty, tradition and order, the rule of law, and belief in God. And I think everything stems from that. And if you look at what anti-Americanism is, it's trying to defeat all of those four things in favor of what the left would have us believe. The left is relentless in the use of propaganda. It's something they learned in the 1920s when communism was first emerging. Propaganda, disinformation, misinformation, all of those other things that they did, they still use the same tactics. They've learned it extremely well, and much of what passes for legitimate information is actually disinformation or propaganda, which they have generated. And I think if you look at what goes on in the world in terms of anti-Americanism, much of it stems from that use of propaganda. They have no hesitation to use deception, lies, as I say, disinformation, which is a very interesting principle, that is planting something that is somewhat untrue but which makes their point and which, if you look at it, follow it, it'll eventually emerge on the front page of the New York Times as if it were true. And you can often trace those things back to something that was planted in some small newspaper someplace that somebody didn't check on the facts, and it becomes the conventional wisdom. When Ronald Reagan arrived in Hollywood in 1947, you remember that he was involved in a dispute with the unions over jurisdiction, and he looked at it and he said it really wasn't about jurisdiction at all. As he said, Joseph Stalin had set out to make Hollywood an instrument of propaganda for his program of Soviet expansionism aimed at communizing the world. Those are Ronald Reagan's words. And I think the same thing goes on today. It may be more subtle than what Stalin was doing then, but it still certainly exists. Richard Pipes yesterday said that most people in the world are not anti-American, and that has been repeated several times, and I think it's absolutely true. The old line is in across the world, Yankee, go home, but take me with you. And they all believe that. I remember one time I was traveling in Syria. I spent a couple of weeks there in 2001. And the Syrian people are enormously friendly. You could run into them on the street and cafes. I was a tourist, and they were just overwhelmingly friendly. And the conversation always went something like this. So you're an American. Well, I don't like your government very much, but then, you know, I don't like our government very much either. And so I assume that you said, I can't do anything about our government, and I assume you can't do anything about your government, so let's be friends. And that I think the same conversation came up again and again and again, and I think it characterized the way so many people in the world think about Americans. So what are we going to do about it? Well, as a domestic thing, there's one thing that everybody in this room can help do, and I would suggest that you all drop what you're doing between now and November and help defeat Barack Obama. As has been suggested, this man is a leftist. He is an ideologue. He hates America. He isn't really an American. I mean, we're not going to go there in terms of where he was born, but he doesn't really believe in American ideals, either to the people that work for him. You look at people like David Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, his wife, the other people that advise him, and they are as ideologically left as he is. The czars that work for him, the people that he has planted throughout the bureaucracy in Washington, all have the same agenda, and that is to denigrate America wherever they can, and I think a great deal of the anti-Americanism that you see is a result of what's going on. Second, act decisively and boldly in promoting America. America, when people lose confidence in what they believe, the rest of the world sees it. And I think that's one of the things that happened, that has happened. It certainly started after Vietnam. John mentioned the anti-Americanism that existed when we went into Iraq. You remember the things like the Somalian crisis during the Clinton administration, where dead bodies of American soldiers were dragged through the streets, where Clinton and Obama, Jimmy Carter, have gone around apologizing about what's wrong with America. All those things are seen in the eyes of both Americans and foreigners as the fact that we don't really believe in what in American principles, and we have to start stating our case clearly, doing the things that will show that we actually believe in America. And I think that'd make a huge difference both domestically and in abroad. Americans have a huge desire they always have to be liked, probably more than any other culture in the history of the world. And I suppose that's because over traditionally Americans have believed in the American cause. But where people see others trying to be liked, they tend to lack of respect. And I think what we need to do is to change our attitude to the extent that we can from trying to be liked to being respected. And we aren't respected in the great many parts of the world as well as at home because of the fact that we simply have not stated clearly where we stand. We have to tell America's story. I think, John, you said that very well in terms of what USIA used to do. There, of course, USIA, as John mentioned, was independent. It was merged into the State Department in the 1990s. You may remember, many of you probably do, our friend Frank Shakespeare, who was head of USIA during the Nixon administration. And he recognized that he was actually sort of told to do what by the State Department. He said the State Department was interested in detente. He was interested in defeating communism, so he sort of told the State Department to go to hell, and he went ahead and did what he thought was right. It cost him his job, but it made a huge amount of difference. And USIA was tremendously effective. Let me just tell you one story, a personal story of mine that I think demonstrates how effective USIA can be. In 1988, I published a book called Red Horizons by a fellow named Ion Michai Pachepa. And Pachepa had been Ceausescu's head of foreign intelligence in Romania. Ceausescu, of course, was one of the most brutal communist dictators in Eastern Europe. And Pachepa had worked for him for probably 15 years, had risen to about the most important position in the government. He defected in 1986. He walked into the American embassy in Bonn on a Sunday afternoon and announced who he was and that he wanted to defect. The person in charge said, well, there was nobody here who could accommodate him, and would he come back tomorrow? typical State Department way to behave. And Pachepa thought it was all over. I mean, he was sure he was being followed by somebody, but in fact, he got back and locked himself in his hotel room, came back on Monday, ultimately came to the United States, was debriefed by the CIA for 3 years. What he knew about inside what was going on inside the communist bloc was overwhelming. Practically destroyed many of their embassies and so on. Anyway, he eventually wrote a book called Red Horizons. And it was turned down by 16 publishers in New York. I finally got it. I had it very carefully fact-checked, and we published it in 1988, I guess it was. And we arranged with USIA to read the book in Romanian into Romanian. What the book did was to tell what was going on inside the Romanian government. Of course, this was at the time that the Soviet bloc was beginning to fall apart. Romania was one of the last to survive. The book was read into Romania, as they say in Romanian, chapter by chapter. Each day they would read a chapter. And I understand the entire country was riveted listening to this account. Eventually, of course, Ceausescu was overthrown. They had a 10-minute trial, not exactly due process by the way we think of it, but nevertheless, it's probably what he deserved, and he was assassinated with his lovely wife, Elena, and I guess you can still see the assassination on YouTube. Anyway, the day afterward, the counter-revolutionaries, the good guys, seized the newspaper, and they proceeded to publish on the front page of the newspaper Red Horizons. And in the caption, it said, this was the book that told us what was going on inside of Romania and which resulted in our overthrowing the government. Pretty effective. And what my lesson from that was that although it's hard to make any money in the book publishing business, if you can overthrow a communist government every now and then, it's worthwhile. We need to conduct ideological warfare, the war of ideas. We can do that by, as I say, using an effective way of the government and so on. But in conclusion, let me just say that we need to believe in America. We need to clearly enunciate the principles of constitutional conservatism, which, as I say, are the same principles that America stands on. Where it's a wonderful story. Even people in the most backward parts of the world, the people across the Arab world and so on, when they hear our story, if it's clearly enunciated, they can't help but some of them anyway believe it, and it will make a huge difference. We aren't doing that at all. Again, the private sector as well can participate in that. I think back at the one time, I remember reading in years ago that the economics department at the University of Chicago had in the same class graduated seven different people who became finance ministers in South America. And those seven members used to have a conference call periodically with their professor at the University of Chicago. How much difference does that make about the way those people felt about America? We need to do that sort of thing. We need to do public diplomacy, and we need to feel good and make people realize how good we feel about what we believe. Thanks.
Thanks, Alex. Dan Flynn.
The panel's called Anti-Americanism Fashioning the Conservative Response. I think we risk disappointment when we imagine that an anti-intellectual phenomenon can be rectified through an intellectual response. And this is the conceit of intellectuals, to always and everywhere think that there's nothing that a good argument can't solve. But the power of persuasion, I think, is simply not very persuasive here, at least when it comes to domestic anti-Americanism. It's hard for people to see anti-intellectualism when it's embraced by intellectuals. That's a problem with anti-Americanism. If it were embraced by people with names like Bubba and Bobby Liu, you know, we'd all be able to see it as the know-nothing movement that it is. But because its exponents are people like Gore Vidal and Susan Sarandon, we imagine anti-Americanism occupying a higher plane than say, jingoism. But really, they're just two sides of the same coin, just unthinking, reflexive. Take, for example, a guy like Noam Chomsky, who may have a higher IQ than everyone in this room, but my suspicion is he's probably been wrong more than anyone in this room. You know? And if you don't know Noam Chomsky, think of Michael Moore with his brain on steroids, or his body on a diet. In the 1970s, Chomsky rather infamously wrote a book review in The Nation magazine where he claimed that the genocide then taking place in Pol Pot's Cambodia was U.S. propaganda. It wasn't going on. And to the extent that there were any killings in Cambodia, it was the U.S.'s fault. In the 80s, Chomsky claimed that the standard of living in Cuba was actually the same or better than the standard of living in the United States. And he said, what we need in America is not so much dissent, but denazification. And just last year, in response to the assassination of Osama bin Laden, Chomsky wrote an article claiming that bin Laden, he called him a victim, he called him a suspect, never called him a terrorist. He claimed that he didn't buy into the idea that bin Laden was behind 9/11, and that, of course, he compared George W. Bush to Hitler, which was something that was like obligatory in the last decade. Chomsky's is a reflexive, non-thinking, programmed anti-Americanism. No matter the geopolitical event, the villain is always America. Anti-Americanism usually manifests itself in this way, as a tic. And when you see someone with a tic, you don't respond. You might look away, or you certainly don't respond. You don't try to persuade the man who's suffering from a tic to stop indulging his tic. You don't debate him about why he's wrong to have the tic. In fact, there's something far more wrong with you than the man with the tic if you go around trying to convince him to stop having his tic. Just let it be. I wrote a thick book a few years back called A Conservative History of the American Left. And when I wrote that book, I was able to interview a number of the leading figures on the left over the course of the last half century or so. And I asked, there was one question that I asked all of these leaders, you know, and the question was basically, what's the animating principle behind the left? What does a leftist believe? And I got all sorts of answers. Some of them were contradictory. Some of them were things that probably you believe. Some of them were incoherent. There was really only one that stood out, and it was from a guy named Al Haber. And Al Haber is a forgotten individual now, but he in the late 1950s, he took a dead organization, the Student League for Industrial Democracy, and he turned it into a very lively organization, the Students for a Democratic Society. He was essentially the founder of SDS. And Al Haber still lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in a modest home filled with books. And when I caught up with him, he was stuffing a mailing late into the night. And I asked him, what is it that a leftist believes? And his answer was, what is the better world that's possible? It's very different from what, you know, most conservatives would believe. I mean, when I think about things, I always think about how they can get worse, you know. And I imagine there's people in the audience that have the same view. But yet he thinks, what's the better world possible? And on the surface, that seems to be a rather optimistic way of looking at the world. But really, if you look at America and you're always saying, what's the better America possible, you're setting yourself up for a lifetime of disappointment and letdown. And I think that partly explains the very negative view that American leftists have for their country. If you compare anything to an ideal, it's always going to fall short. Nothing ever lives up to the ideal. And so rather than compare America to an ideal, you know, perhaps a healthier way of looking at at America would be to compare America to places that actually exist in the world. I mean, think right now. There's a big discussion about a war on women, metaphorical war on women that the Republicans are apparently perpetrating. There are places in the world where there's actually a war on women. We heard about it last night. Just last month, the leading human rights group in Pakistan came out with a study documenting 943 instances of honor killings in Pakistan last year. And in almost every instance, there wasn't even a pretense of an investigation. There is a war on women in the world, and there are actually casualties. This is happening. Prisoners' rights is a big hobby horse for a lot of folks on the left. Angela Davis has made it a crusade. I wonder why, thinking of her biography. But you know, it's usually used as sort of a brickbat upon which to beat the United States. And I'm sure a lot of you are probably saying prisoners' rights. Isn't that why they go to prison to have their rights taken away? But obviously, you know, nevertheless, prisoners maintain some rights. A couple months back, you may have missed it because it wasn't widely covered. There was a prison fire in Honduras where you had over 350 inmates just immolated, you know, dead, because of the horrid prison conditions that they have there. But because that doesn't serve an agenda, it doesn't serve sort of the anti-American agenda, the people who are all up in arms about prisoners' rights, they're not talking about that. The big story over the course of the last month has been this tragedy, a 17-year-old boy murdered, I'm not remember, killed by a, I don't know, neighborhood paladin, you know, neighborhood watch guy in a gated community in Florida. And for Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, this proves American racism. But if we avert our gaze from Central Florida and we look at, say, like South Sudan, where every week or so in the New York Times there is a story about a dozen people here, 100 people there, getting killed because they belong to the wrong tribe. And then the next week, the people with the other tribe getting killed. What's going on in South Sudan, that's, you know, some pretty heavy stuff. I mean, what's happening in America is certainly not healthy. There's a lot of racial antagonism that's been stoked. But when you compare it to what's actually going on in the world, it's minor stuff in comparison. There are... And so what I would suggest to the left is sort of to practice what they preach with regard to multiculturalism. Don't just fixate. You know, don't be the man with the muckrake and always looking down and you know, looking at America in such a negative way. But don't fixate in America. Look at the world. Look what's actually going on. And if you do study other cultures, we start to look rather exemplary in comparison. There are cultural markers that certainly separate America, not just from the third world, but from the rest of the West. And these are things like a tradition of free enterprise, you know, belief in God, religion. I think when they do the surveys every few years, the Pew does it. The church going in attendance in the United States is more so than any other industrialized nation, except I think Poland and Ireland. So that's a cultural marker. I had a German friend who came to America, and she was struck by how many flags we hung up. She thought we were a bunch of Nazis having flags everywhere. And that's something that would strike foreigners as odd, the patriotism. These cultural markers provide a logical reason why those on the left would display an illogical anti-American tick. So the folks on the American left, they perform a really delicate balancing act. They can, you know, either be purist left-wingers, and if they're pure, they will alienate the American people because those cultural markers are things that offend leftists. Or they can be pragmatic and embrace some of those cultural markers, and they risk alienating the purists. And when I wrote this book, Conservative History of the American Left, I was struck by one of the characters, a guy by the name of J.A. Weyland, who was the publisher of a periodical, a weekly called Appeal to Reason. And Appeal to Reason really was, I think, the most successful publication in the history of the American left. About 100 years ago, they had over a million subscribers. And they were successful because they embraced America. It was published not from Boston or Washington, D.C. It was published from Girard, Kansas. And right in the middle of America. Weyland was a socialist who could have taught any capitalist a thing about capitalism. He could have taught any capitalist how to run a business. And when you read Appeal to Reason, the way they stylized socialism was that it was a political version of Christianity, that Jesus Christ was the first socialist. And you could see how in a country like America, that would be a lot more appealing than saying, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses or something like that. That's not going to get you anywhere here. Weyland had enormous success. If you contrast Weyland to, say, the various incarnations of the Communist Party or the Weathermen, these are people that through most of the history of their organizations, were at war on America. The only time that I think, the Communist Party, the one time when it had a measurable degree of popularity in the 1930s was when its slogan was "Communism is 20th century Americanism." But when these institutions were so anti-American that they wanted to not only take away our democratic form of government, but install foreign overlords over us, however ridiculous that sounds, they didn't just repulse conservatives; they repulsed other people on the American left. So. An American left that defines itself by hostility to religion, patriotism, the family, free enterprise, that American left can never truly be American. And an American left that embraces religion, patriotism, the family, and free enterprise, that American left can never truly be left. So they have a dilemma. One would think that living in America would be an antidote to domestic anti-Americanism. You think about the airplane and the computer and the internet and the iPod and all these great inventions, the CAT scan, Jonas Salk inventing a vaccine for polio. If that's not going to convince you that anti-Americanism is foolish, then I don't know that there's any words that I can say that would convince someone like that. I mean, if the experience of living in America doesn't convince you, then all of the talk in the world isn't going to bring you over either. The pull of ideology is even greater than the pull of reality, at least in this instance. Let me close with a quote from a guy who I think in this room is a lot more like than Michael Moore and Noam Chomsky and some of these people I've been talking about. Edmund Burke said, "To make us love our country ought to be lovely." And I would submit to you that most Americans love America not merely because it's our country, although that's a good reason of loving America, but we love America because it's lovely. Thank you so much.
And now in the coveted spot of cleanup hitter, Grover Norquist.
Right. Well, in response to the question, what is to be done, I think the answer is given to us by a title of a book James Fallows wrote where he was relating a discussion where Americans were wondering, what should we do in the 80s in response to the Japanese challenge, their economic success? What part of Japan should we emulate? And Fallows, and one of the people there said, no, we should be more like us. The answer is we should be more like us. Now, how do we get there? How do we accomplish that if we're trying to defend liberty and freedom and be a beacon of same? How do we get to do that? Bertolt Brecht in 53, when the East Germans put down a workers' revolt over there, which is kind of embarrassing since they're supposed to be representing the workers, rather brutally commented that what the East Germans should do is elect a new people. And I want to suggest that that's what we can do. We can create a new electorate, a new people. The left has a whole cottage industry explaining the demographics are on their side. They say, take a look at how many African Americans there are and how many Hispanics there are now and how many turn 21 in X number of years, and they count all women on their team, and they take this demographic trend and they say, see, in 10, 20, or 30 years, we win. And that follows their politics, follows their demographic theory of how they're going to change the country. They try and divide people on racial lines, on income lines, on gender lines, on ethnicity, in order to then drive the case that, see, as you get more of X, Y, and Z, we win. And I want to argue that what we really need to look at are those vote-moving issues that individuals and families vote on, and how we can create more of us in the electorate. And some examples that are things that are not hypotheticals, but things that are actually going on. 20 years ago, in all 50 states, homeschooling was largely illegal. Today, it's largely legal in 50 states. There are 1.5 million parents presently homeschooling, 2.5 million kids being homeschooled. If you go back, there are now 10 million adults who were homeschooled, and 4 million parents who have homeschooled. Those are different voters and different people than parents who send their kids to the government school to be babysat for 12 years. It becomes a central part of their life, and it changes how they vote. Talk to a homeschooler. They are much more radical individualists and self-assured and self-confident, and they run their own lives. And the polling data on the people who were homeschooled is very healthy for the modern Republican Party. The school choice movement of allowing people to go to private schools, not just homeschooling, but private schools, is finally, we always knew that if we could sort of break through and get one state to really move this forward, that it would be unstoppable. We now have 11 states with significant school choice voucher tax credits for scholarship programs, but we just had Indiana pass a law that will, over the next 3 years, allow half of the students in Indiana vouchers. Louisiana just passed a law which also will move to half the students. We're talking about 1 million students now. It'll be difficult the next time we go to the ballot in California or Michigan for the other team to explain that school choice means witches schools and all these other things that they explained would happen, because there'll be that many examples. But a parent who controls where they send their kid to school, a parent who's decided the government school's not where they want, a private school is what they want, a teacher who teaches at a private school is a different person and a different voter than somebody who belongs to the teachers' union, has a government worker's pension, and a government worker's attitude towards life. The concealed carry movement in the United States. Again, 30 years ago, Vermont was the only state where you had the right, by virtue of just being a citizen, to carry a gun concealed. Now, in over 40 states, we have shall-issue concealed carry laws, where you walk in, you're not a criminal, you're not insane, you can shoot a gun, and you pay $100. You can have a concealed carry permit. 7 million Americans carry concealed today with permits. Now, add to that that other states had said, we want what Vermont has, okay? We want to be able to just have a concealed carry because we say so. And the challenge was that when you pass that law, Vermonters can't carry their gun across the border into New Hampshire. They don't have a concealed carry permit there. So the new standard for concealed carry laws are Arizona, Wyoming, Alaska, which says in-state you don't need a permit to carry concealed. But if you want a concealed carry permit so you can drive across the country with other states that recognize the concealed carry permit of Alaska and Arizona and Wyoming, you can. Again, the Second Amendment, people who care about liberty, people who care about the Second Amendment, there was a secular decline happening, largely because every generation, about 25% of hunters have been declining in terms of the number of hunters. Not deer hunters. Deer hunters are doing fine. The foo-foo bird hunters are what's been declining. And the challenge is that with hunters, yes, they care about the Second Amendment vaguely because every year for a couple weekends they go out and irritate Bambi's relatives. But that's a different level of commitment to the Second Amendment than 7 million people carrying a gun in the small of their back. You'll never take their Second Amendment rights away. You have changed the nature of the people who carry concealed. 7 million. We see the same thing going on with labor unions. We've seen the secular decline in labor unions, largely by not changing the laws to force people into unions, to the point where about 11-12% of the working population are in unions, 7% of the private sector, 35% of government workers are unionized. We're all familiar with what Wisconsin did. Wisconsin passed a law which, among other things, said the state and local governments will no longer withhold your union dues. Now, you're a member of the teachers' union. You can belong to the teachers' union. Nobody says you can't. But we're not withholding for a teacher who makes $50,000 a year in salary in Wisconsin, $1,000 dues. Okay? When it came out of your paycheck, and collected by the local government and given to the teachers' union in Wisconsin, your hostility was not to the union for that $1,000. You never even saw that $1,000. The teachers' union representative came and told you cheerful things about what they were doing for you. Today in Wisconsin, when the union leadership comes to talk to you, they want your $1,000. They're not your friends. And so this changes the nature of the relationship. The changes in teacher tenure. Idaho, no teacher tenure. Florida, no teacher tenure. They changed the rules in Louisiana. So they still call it teacher tenure, but half of teachers don't have it. So, you know, the less quality teachers don't have it. And if you ever screw up and fall down into the lower half, you don't have it for another 5 years. They might as well not have teacher tenure because it doesn't protect people who aren't doing their jobs. The teachers who operate as teachers without tenure are different people than people who have tenure, K through 12. It changes the nature of the voters. Demographics can change, and it's not just all racial or gender or income. We're talking about the demographics of vote-moving issues. Now, government workers, great polling data done by Scott Rasmussen. In general, if you're a government worker, you're 10% more Democrat. Hold the job for 20 years, you're 30% more Democrat. Get paid more than $75,000 a year, you're 30% more Democrat. So having your kid work at the school, at the town pool, will not ruin him or scar him for life. But once you've worked for the government long enough, it begins to change the nature of who you are. Because among other things, at some point you look out and say, if I was ever to go back out into the private sector, nobody pays what they pay here. Nobody has a pension like they do here, and they expect you to work. So, again, this changes the nature of the electorate, which is why the solution, every Democrat solution we've heard over the last 30 years, 100,000 more teachers, 100,000 more cops. They always want 100,000 more government workers because they know they do well off the top there. Now, the counterpart to that is the emerging investor class. And again, Scott Rasmussen's done some great polling. If you have $5,000 worth of stock in a 401k, an IRA, a flexible savings account, all these various ways of saving $5,000 or more, it makes you, on average, 18% more Republican than Democrat. Okay, that's true for all demographics. Poor people who own stock are more Republican. Rich people who own stock are more Republican. Men, women, private government workers, private sector workers. It moves everybody in the right direction with one exception, and that is women who earn more than $75,000 a year, who are already fairly Republican, but $5,000 worth of stock does not move them in the right direction. So if you know any women like that, don't give them any stock. it does absolutely no good. However, if you buy them a gun,